Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Her Half of History, an Evergreen podcast. My name is Lori. The current series is The Last Queen, and this is episode 12.4, Zenobia, Last Empress of Palmyra. Just in case any of you thought Palmyra was a small city in upstate New York, you should know that the original Palmyra is an ancient city in what is now Syria. Though it sat surrounded by desert, Palmyra was rich because it had natural springs. It was an oasis city sitting right along the Silk Road. Merchant caravans from both east and west passed through Palmyra and paid handsomely for the privilege of setting up camp and watering their camels. For a long time, Palmyra managed to be neutral. It was a place where everyone was welcome to stop, so long as they could pay, without fear of either the Roman Empire to the west or the Parthian Empire to the east. But of course, that wasn't going to last. By the time Zenobia was born around 240 CE, Palmyra was fully incorporated into the Roman Empire. It was still a very cosmopolitan place. It had Romans, but also Greeks and Jews and Aramaeans and Mesopotamians and Bedouins and Arabians. Arabs, as we know them, weren't yet a cultural or ethnic identity people understood, but there were people from the Arabian Peninsula. These are precursors of modern-day Arabs, if you like. Religiously, Palmyrians worshipped gods from all of these places, often interchangeably. So Zenobia may have worshipped at Palmyra's impressive temple of Baal Shamin, an Aramaean god, or at the equally impressive temple of Bel, a Mesopotamian god. The temple of Alat, an Arabian goddess, was smaller but still important. When Palmyrians wrote in Greek, they translated Alat as Athena. Palmyra certainly could have had Christians. It did not yet have Muslims for the simple reason that Muhammad hadn't been born yet. Linguistically, Palmyrians spoke an Aramaic language related to Hebrew. But Zenobia herself was said to also speak Greek, Latin, and even Egyptian and Arabic. Zenobia is her Greek and Latin name. In Palmyrene, she's called Bath-Zabai. As per usual in ancient sources, childhood is irrelevant. Nobody mentions Zenobia's. We don't know who her parents were, or which of all those ethnicities contributed the most to her DNA. But most likely she considered herself Roman. Palmyra was a Roman colonia, a city of status. Most of its people were Roman citizens. Roman was a multiracial ethnicity. The first we hear anything about Zenobia is as wife of Odenathus, the prince of Palmyra. Odenathus ruled as a client king of Rome, and Rome loved him. Or at least they gritted their teeth and pretended to love him, because they couldn't afford to do anything else. Third century Rome was a disaster. Among other problems, Emperor Valerian led a campaign against the Persians, and not only did he lose, but he also got himself captured and executed. No enemy had ever dared execute a Roman emperor before. That was a privilege Roman senators and generals liked to keep for themselves. To have an enemy do the same thing was humiliating. Odenathus, prince of Palmyra, took his army and hot-footed it after the Persian army, defeating them before they could return across the Euphrates. Thus Rome was avenged, the empire was secured, and Gallienus, the new emperor, named Odenathus commander of the east. Odenathus continued his campaigning eastward, and the title he liked for himself was King of Kings. The problem with success like that is that the more you succeed, the more other people are afraid of you. Gallienus was a weak emperor. He couldn't afford strong subordinates. In 268, Odenathus was murdered, as was his oldest son and heir. This was not Zenobia's son. This son was from a previous marriage. Gallienus is a likely suspect here, but the word in the Roman sources was that Odenathus's own cousin did it, and that Zenobia egged him on because she wanted her own son, Vabalathus, to inherit. The truth is, more than one person had a motive here. The evidence is long gone and the accounts conflict. We'll never know for sure. The point was, Zenobia was now a widow, and her son Vabalathus inherited Palmyra. But Vabalathus was still little, about 10 years old, and that is where widows get their chance. Also, in some cases, their motivation. As a young and vulnerable prince of Palmyra, Vabalathus, too, was a target. Zenobia set about protecting him. She proclaimed him King of Kings and installed herself as regent. The Palmyrenes seemed to have accepted this without batting an eye. Rome was less pleased, but they had other problems. Gallienus had inherited a mess, and under his reign, it remained a mess. The Historia Augusta, one of our best sources on this period, was not written by a fan of Gallienus. In fact, the author says, "Now all shame is exhausted, for in the weakened state of the Commonwealth things came to such a pass that while Gallienus conducted himself in the most evil fashion, even women ruled most excellently." I mean, ouch, that burns. Zenobia is, of course, the woman he means, and yes, she was doing a just fine job. Nor was she trying to break with Rome. She continued to send Rome its taxes, which were not trivial, 1/4 of all the caravan trade. When Gallienus got stabbed to death just a few months later, Claudius II came to the throne, and Zenobia dutifully had her coin mint switched to producing coins with his image. But it didn't help her. Claudius declared her a usurper anyway, and it's entirely possible that it was his court that began the rumors that she had murdered her husband. It made good propaganda, since Odenathus was such a Roman hero. The truth was, Claudius planned to rule the East himself, and he didn't want anyone of any gender doing it for him. Zenobia could have rolled over and said, "All right then, if that's the way you feel about it," but she didn't. She chose to go on the offensive instead. To challenge Rome's power, she was going to have to be too big to fail, too powerful to intimidate, too wealthy to outspend. Palmyra, the oasis city, did not fit the bill. She began seizing Arabian provinces starting in 270. It would be fabulous if we had an account of her thoughts and strategy at this point, but we do not. The moral of the story here is that if you don't want your enemies to write your story, you should write it yourself. Our accounts are all Roman. Palmyrene was absolutely a written language, but they, like so many others, did not leave us a great body of histories, dramas, and epic poetry. They only left us inscriptions, like a surviving one which reads, "For the life and victory of Septimius Vabalathus Athenodorus, illustrious King of Kings, and Eponothortes of all the East, son of Septimius Odenathus, King of Kings, and for the life of Septimia Bathzebai, illustrious queen, mother of the King of Kings, daughter of Antiochus, mile 14. As a human interest story, it lacks something, but it's quite a mouthful for a mile marker, which is what it is. You just have to read in the human interest bit by watching how these mile markers begin to expand after 270. There's a lot of miles on the road to Egypt, and that was what Zenobia, or Bathzebai, had in mind. Her general Zabdas led 70,000 soldiers and took Alexandria for his queen. Then the Roman prefect came home and took it back. Then the Palmyrene army came and took it for a second time. By 271, Zenobia was appointing administrators for her new Egyptian province, and official papyri were labeled as being under the joint rule of Vabalathus and Aurelian. Who's Aurelian? Well, he's the new emperor of Rome. If it seems like we're going through emperors like tissues and hay fever season, it's because that's exactly what we are doing. I didn't even have time to mention Quintilius, who only lasted a few weeks. Anyway, now we've got Aurelian as merely the latest in a growing list of powerful men who are not at all pleased with Zenobia. He certainly didn't recognize the 11 or 12-year-old Vabalathus as co-ruler of anything, especially not Egypt, the breadbasket of the empire. You do kind of have to wonder why Zenobia included Aurelian at all on these official papyri, but it seems she was still trying to preserve the fiction that she ruled on Rome's behalf, hoping that Aurelian would be too busy with other problems to put up any serious resistance. In the meantime, she also had an army up in Asia Minor, expanding her empire in the other direction at the same time. Back at home, the great colonnade of Palmyra, a main thoroughfare lined with columns and arches, received a new inscription, which said in both Greek and Palmyrene, more or less, Septimia Zenobia, most illustrious pious queen. The Septimioi Zabdas, the chief general, and Zabaios, chief of the army at Tadmor, honor their lady. The Greek word Basilissa there, for queen, can be translated as empress instead, but it was not the term used for empresses of Rome. That word was Augusta, the feminine version of Augustus, the title Aurelian currently held. Zenobia waited all the way until 272, the following year, to claim that one. Then there's an inscription that reads, For Septimia Zenobia Augusta, mother of our eternal lord, Imperator Babalathus Athenodorus. Zenobia had just declared herself not merely a queen of queens under a Roman emperor, but the emperor's equal. Just why she decided this now is unclear because the dates are unclear. Possibly she declared that, and then Aurelian sent his army in response. Or maybe she declared that because Aurelian had already sent his army. Either way, there was no hope of reconciliation now.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, we have this superb podcast called We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by Billy Joel.
It is the most original, fascinating, and random way to learn the story of the 20th century.
Oh, pretty darned random. And we are joined by some pretty incredible guests.
I only wrote stuff that I wanted to hear. If it turned out to be a hit, it was pure dumb luck.
With me, Katie Puckrick.
And me, Tom Fordyce.
This is We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Aurelian marched across Asia Minor and retook it easily. Zenobia wasn't really fighting for it. She was waiting for him in northern Syria. The first major clash was just north of Antioch in May or June of 272. The Palmyrenes were heavily armored, but the Roman cavalry played them. They ran just out of reach until the Palmyrenes were exhausted in their heavy armor. Then the horses turned and crushed them into the ground. It was a disaster for Zenobia, but she wasn't done yet. In one of the most audacious bits of show business in history, Zenobia hatched a plan. She needed to get well away from Antioch before anyone in town realized that Rome was the power to please here and handed her over to them. So while Aurelian's army mopped up north of town, Zenobia simply declared victory in town. She even, get this, found some poor chump to impersonate Aurelian and had him paraded through town as her prisoner. While the townspeople were cheering and partying, she and her general Zabdas scooted south out of town at top speed. The parties were probably still going on when the real Aurelian showed up at the gates with his army. Some conquerors take the view that you've got to be brutal to towns you take because fear keeps the ones you've already got in line. Aurelian took the opposite view. His theory was you grant mercy to towns you take because it encourages the next town to surrender quickly. And it worked for him. Units all across Syria defected to Rome. Meanwhile, another Roman army retook Egypt. The switch was not hard for these people. They had been Roman before, then very briefly Palmyrene. Now they were Roman again. Zenobia fought and lost another battle at Emesa. There's a map on my website, herhalfofhistory.com. And now she was down to only the city of Palmyra itself. Palmyra had no treasury left. It also had no city walls. All it had going for it was desert on every side that made it hard to approach. Hard, but not impossible. Aurelian's army was moving forward, and many in Palmyra thought their best plan was to surrender and hope for some of that famous Aurelian mercy. Zenobia did not think that Mercy was going to extend as far as herself. She fled east on a female camel. The sources make a big point about that female camel, leading me to wonder whether there's something about female camels I don't know. But Zenobia made it many miles across the desert to the Euphrates River. Unfortunately, she got caught there and dragged back. And here we have a curious twist of being female in a patriarchal world. As long as Zenobia was winning, the sources describe her as being very masculine. The Historia Augusta uses phrases like, "Her voice was clear and like that of a man." Another writer, Zosimus, says, "She had the courage of a man." But as soon as she had lost, everyone is at pains to explain how feminine she is. Edward Gibbons, author of the 18th century History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, manages to be the very most insulting. He has praised her to the skies up to this point. Now, he says, "But as female fortitude is commonly artificial, so is it seldom steady or consistent. The courage of Zenobia deserted her in the hour of trial. She trembled at the angry clamors of the soldiers who called aloud for her immediate execution, and she ignominiously purchased life by the sacrifice of her fame and her friends." Zosimus agrees that Zenobia escaped death by blaming the whole escapade on her male friends and advisors. They had seduced her as a simple woman. The scholar Longinus definitely got executed, and General Zabdas disappears from the record, so he was a likely victim too. Now, I will allow that it is certainly possible that Zenobia betrayed her friends and played the just-a-dumb-woman card. It's not admirable, but fear of death is fear of death. I will even grit my teeth and allow that it is possible that Zenobia really was a manipulated woman. These men might have been the real power behind the throne. But Zosimus gives us a little hint about another possibility. Before he gets to anything Zenobia says about being a simple woman in captivity, Zosimus says that Aurelian, quote, "became uneasy at the reflection that in future ages it would not redound to his honor to have conquered a woman," end quote. You see it? It was better for Aurelian to blame her advisors. There was no shame in having suffered temporary losses before crushing a group of rebellious men. That happened all the time. It was sort of glorious. A woman was something else again. He was primed to believe that Zenobia was not and could not have been the intellect or the power behind the Palmyrene rebellion. He did not want to believe it. Therefore, it must have been her advisors. They died. Zenobia lived. Aurelian returned to Rome in triumph, and he took Zenobia and her children with him. Here, we get diverging accounts. Zosimus says Zenobia died en route, either of disease or starvation. The Historia Augusta gives her a much longer life. According to it, she made it to Rome, where she initially received the treatment Cleopatra had killed herself to avoid. Quote, "She was led in triumph, with such magnificence that the Roman people had never seen a more splendid parade. For in the first place she was adorned with gems so huge that she labored under the weight of her ornaments. For it is said that this woman, courageous though she was, halted very frequently, saying that she could not endure the load of her gems. Furthermore, her feet were bound with shackles of gold, and her hands with golden fetters, and even on her neck she wore a chain of gold." Afterwards it goes on, "Her life was granted her by Aurelian, and they say that thereafter she lived with her children in the manner of a Roman matron, on an estate that had been presented to her at Tibur." Yes, it turns into a sort of happily ever after, which was an unexpected twist. So unexpected it's tempting to assume it's just wrong. We cannot prove either way, but there is some slight evidence that it might be true. Subsequent generations of Romans from that area have names that indicate they might possibly have been her descendants. As for the kingdom of Palmyra, it never rose again. They tried another revolt the following year, but Aurelian came back and he wasn't so merciful on a second go-around. The caravan trade was routed differently, and Palmyra lost much of its wealth. Over the centuries, it became first a Christian city and then a Muslim one. In the 17th century, European tourists realized what a forgotten gem Palmyra was. The Great Colonnade, the Temple of Baal Shamin, the Temple of Bel, the stone lion of the goddess Alat, the Roman amphitheater. The very buildings and monuments where Zenobia herself had once walked and worshipped and ruled, they were all still there, looking glorious. See pictures on my website. A great many of these smaller artifacts went home in European pockets, but the city continued to attract tourists and archaeologists. That kind of staying power is what makes the current situation so tragic. In May of 2015, the Islamic State, or ISIS, took Palmyra. They killed the director of Palmyra's antiquities and the Palmyra Museum. Then they proceeded to destroy the monuments which had stood there for almost 2,000 years. The temples of Bel and Baal Shamin, they blew up. The arches on the Great Colonnade are no longer there. The lion statue of Alat was toppled and her nose broken off. The Roman amphitheater remained intact. And in 2015, the world knew it was intact because ISIS released videos of it. They were using it as a staging ground for executions. Every faction in Syria has been eager to claim Zenobia as the great Syrian heroine, and her story is a potent symbol for resistance to Western imperialism and culture. That is exactly what she was. But ISIS has used her for propaganda even while destroying her city and slaughtering its people. I'll leave you to decide what Zenobia would have thought of that. My major source for today is Zenobia, Shooting Star of Palmyra by Nathaniel J. Andrade. Check out the website, herhalfofhistory.com, for other sources, a transcript, and pictures. The website also has ways to support. Supporters on Patreon and Into History help keep this show going, and I am so grateful for them. My gratitude translates into ad-free episodes and or bonus episodes, depending on which option you choose. If that's not in the cards for you, likes, reviews, and ratings also help much more than you might think in raising visibility and bringing in other listeners. We now have spent 4 episodes on queens who either directly challenged Rome or at least had Rome hulking just off the scenes. But Rome is now done. Finished history. We are moving on all the way to the other end of the Silk Road, not even stopping in China, but we'll march right on past it to Korea and its last queen. Don't miss it. Thanks.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
Hello, my name is Peter Zablocki, and I'm a historian, author, and college professor. I'm thrilled to invite you to check out Evergreen Network's History Shorts podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, join me on a journey through time, exploring the little-known and hidden gems of history. In each bite-sized episode, I'll dive into my original research to bring you intriguing historical curiosities you've probably never heard of, uncovering the fascinating stories that have shaped our world, from forgotten figures to overlooked events. And the best part? I've condensed all this historical goodness into manageable chunks, perfect for your on-the-go lifestyle. Whether you're commuting to work or squeezing in a quick break, History Shorts fits into the little time you probably think you don't have. Subscribe now and never miss an episode of the History Shorts podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.